Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if I were to live in a Michael Crichton dystopia, I would most want to live in the aftermath of the great train robbery where everyone got away.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and if I were to live in a Michael Crichton dystopia, I would clearly choose Timeline so that I could travel back to the very sexually, 14th century medieval France where women definitely got to do things, and it was great.
It was a very liberated time.
Sure.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to live in any of one of Michael Crichton's dystopias, I'm going with Westworld from the 1973 movie Westworld, written and directed by Michael Crichton.
Yeah, and then Neil lives out the plot of the Westworld HBO series by going to Westworld and falling in love with one of the robots.
Oh, listen. No, you become Ed Harris? There are worse things to have happen to you.
Yeah, I'll take Ed Harris as me in my 60s.
He'll be super rich, and we'll enjoy being his friend in that period of time while he's making his Westworld better and also slowly going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be perfect.
Yeah, that actually sounds a little bit like my life in general.
I don't know which parts, but I guess half the surprise is finding out. You're listening to A Storm of Spoilers. This episode, we will be talking about Michael Crichton's books and television projects and attempts to direct things. But first, as we always do, we are going to check in with Joanna Robinson to see if we have any reviews.
It's a good day to check in with me and find out if we have any good reviews, because I'm definitely all on top of this review thing. Let me just say for a second that, like, while I pull up the reviews that I definitely already had ready to go, that have you guys watched Timeline recently? Because I watched it today.
No,
I have not.
I feel like Timeline's one of those movies that's like, oh, there's like a good movie buried in there, and we should reboot it, the three of us, as a limited series. All right, some reviews. Papa Baggins 3446 gave us 5 stars. And just says he likes it. He really likes it. And says, I'm enjoying the off-season content. The discussions are some. I would have my own friends and family. And then I'm going to read one more with a bummer title. 5 stars. Bitchin' Podcast is the name of the person who left it. Too late, comma, I fell down.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's tough.
And then, this might be, okay, I didn't pre-read this, but here we go. Poop, hehe, just wanted you to say poop on the podcast. Hashtag rant, hashtag fuck you iTunes. Why does Apple make it so hard to review from anyone outside of the Apple anti-utopia? Had to install iTunes just to be able to write a review. Hashtag rant over. Well, I have to say, love the podcast, love the host, been listening for quite some time. But the New Year's resolution of don't fall down just rang with me, so here it is. I started listening to Joanna on Cast of Kings around season 5, yes, late discovery, and decided to branch out into your other material, bringing me to a storm of spoilers. So much fun, and every time, witty and informed hosts, great material, I just can't praise it enough. Keep up the great work. I hope that you keep the off-season tour going, even after the presumably apocalyptic ending of Game of Thrones. Storm of Spoilers, a pop culture podcast. So the title of this review, I was on a business trip in Malaysia, Penang Island, and it rained the entire first week. The sidewalks were like shiny floor tiles covered in a veneer of water. Not wanting to get too wet, I was walking fast, only to find myself hitting a floor and almost sliding into the road. Ouch. Hashtag I fell down. Keep up the great work. I can't wait for each new episode.
Man, we lost one already.
Yeah.
I have not fallen yet. Neil, how are you doing with our resolution?
Oh, I'm good, but I am also going to a snowy, slippery, icy place for like 9 days. So the chance of me surviving that without falling is,
Well, if you fall down, will you take a photo of yourself for our listeners?
Oh, yeah.
And Dave, how are you doing with this resolution?
Still haven't fallen down. I'm going to see now I feel the pressure of being on the vanguard of uprightness. So I've been very cautious.
Rupert
been
Murdoch
drinking less,
down.
Been going out less. Ooh, Rupert Murdoch fell down. Mm-hmm. Take that, Rupert Murdoch.
Hashtag fall down 2018, Rupert Murdoch.
That's what he gets for not listening to our show.
Yeah.
Have you been doing a Cast of Kings since 2005?
I think he said season 5.
Oh, season 5. Oh, okay. I misheard and was like, I misunderstand chronology. Good. Good to know. We're not in the timeline universe yet, in conclusion. Neil, your segment's called We Talked About This Already. I hear we're going to learn about crocodiles.
Yes. But first we have Game of Thrones stuff.
Oh, I like that too.
Yeah. As a reminder, Con of Thrones, still happening in May. You guys should come. We're going to be there. They announced this week several guests who are all delightful humans. Returning from last year, Kate Dickey, who's a lot of fun, and Amy Richardson, who's a very lovely person. And I hope I'm not going to screw up her name, but she played Roz. Esme Bianco, is that how you say that?
I think you nailed it, friend.
Yeah, nailed it. She will be there. She's a new guest this year. And of course, remember, these are... I would imagine, I don't have any inside knowledge, but I would imagine this is not all of the guests who will be coming.
This is just the tip of the guestberg, what I would say.
Tip of the guestberg, indeed.
I'm so excited that Kate Dickey is coming back, because
she was
not only
very
is she
funny.
So rad, but also she's been in a Star Wars since last we saw her, so, you know, that'll be fun to talk about.
She had been in a Star Wars when we saw her before. She was just incredibly good about not bringing that up. Kate Dickey. Genius.
Dave's going to walk up to her and be like, you didn't tell me you were withholding
you it from have me. Vested me, madam.
He already did that to her on Twitter, in fact.
I accidentally caused her to think she'd maybe leaked something by trying to compliment her, as is my wont.
All right. So those are guests that will be there. That's awesome. A little bit of news out of the TCAs, I believe, is that there won't be a spinoff until 2020. This is, correct me if I'm wrong, Joanna, because you were actually at the TCAs, something Casey Bloys said during some sort of HBO panel.
It is something that he said during some kind of HBO panel, during the exec session, I believe.
Ooh.
And it's not surprising, because he did say, like, he has been saying sort of from the start that, you know, the final season of Game of Thrones will wrap up, there will be some air, and then they will start the spinoff. So if the final season of Game of Thrones is 2019, it makes sense that the first season of the spinoff would be 2020. Makes a lot of sense to me.
I guess here's a question that I have about that. And this is pure speculation, I guess, at this point. Unless Casey Bloys also said something about this at TCAs. Are we to assume then that it's possible they're going to have characters from the main show in the spinoff?
They have said for a very long time that there will be no characters from the main show in the spinoff.
Do we believe
them? We'll see what happens.
Because why else? I guess, well, I mean, maybe they're using the same crews, I guess, or same locations. Because I'm like, well, why do they need a break? Why can't they just start shooting it while they're shooting the other season if no one is involved?
They haven't even cast it yet.
Yeah, I mean, but they have a long time.
It's 2018.
Yeah, that's true.
They have to cast the whole thing. They have to write. They have to shoot a pilot. They have to talk about it. They have to fix it. Remember how the Game of Thrones pilot, they had to like throw the whole thing out and reshoot the entire thing from scratch?
That's true. Hopefully they don't have to do that again. Hopefully they've learned some lessons.
That's what they get for employing a hack like Tom McCarthy.
Anyway, just something to put a pin in. I'm like, the break seems weird to me. But the 2020 thing doesn't surprise me from like a marketing scheduling standpoint.
Well, honestly, to that end, like, why, you know, if it is like the Torment Chronicles or whatever, I believe that Christopher Hivju like could, you know, film right after. Like, I don't think using the same cast would be a reason to delay. I really think it's just to give it as much of a chance as possible to be as on solid footing as possible. If I were them, and they also think that they like, it has to do with like Weiss and Benioff and respect for them, I think, like letting that finale have space to breathe. Mm. Because if I were them from a business point of view, I would have the finale lead right into the premiere of the spinoff. You know what I mean?
Right. Or at least have a trailer ready to go.
Yeah. And they might, you know, like, let's say this, you know, let's say this airs in spring 2019, the final season of Game of Thrones. And then the spinoff premieres, I don't know, early winter. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just saying they could have like a teaser. They probably will have a teaser of some kind. Right?
Yeah. Don't you seems think? I mean,
they'll
it
have like production
seems like a missed
footage,
opportunity if they don't.
They'll be like, from the brains that brought you all this dinosaur shit. I mean, dragon shit. Is more dragon shit starring new pretty people that you haven't met yet.
So what I feel is going to happen is they're going to, you know, grab that teaser, but it's going to air at the end of Westworld season 3 in spring of 2020. They're gonna
from different people who brought you
from
these
different
sexy
people.
Robots.
You thought you were done with dragons and fully invested in robots, but guess what?
Stuff.
You're mere 4 months away from becoming obsessed with dragons for an indeterminate amount of time once again.
Dragons for always. This time we don't have to deal with books. It'll be great.
I'm hoping that eventually we stop long leading everything and that what's happening with Star Wars Solo becomes back in vogue, where it's like, I don't know what movies are coming out in 3 months. I mean, I have a vague idea there's a movie coming out in 3 months, but I don't know what's in it anymore. I'm just going to have to wait and see. They're going to tell me when they feel like telling me.
The secret Game of Thrones spinoffs.
There's a new show coming. Maybe it doesn't have any dragons at all. You don't know. In a world. Right.
No. That is quiet piano keys. Dum, bum. And then cut to black. And everyone's like, what was that teaser for? And then we have to post things that are like, obviously.
Obviously.
Didn't you hear the two piano sense. Notes?
Okay, so.
Unmistakably Jawadi. Come on. All right.
back to pretty people who are actually in Game of Thrones that actually exists currently. The big news this week is that they've resumed filming and Kit Harington's back in Belfast. Yay. Good job. Keep making that show. Moving
but I
on.
Thought Kit Harington just likes to go to Belfast sometimes.
That's
like,
true. Sometimes he's just there for
just,
the
like,
party.
Stays there for a year.
It's crazy. He keeps going there and going to that same pub, which I assume is like across the street from the hotel where all the Game of Thrones people stay. So he loves that one pub. That's
yeah. Let's okay.
They don't throw him out when he gets too drunk. That's why.
Right.
Joanna, you learn electric guitar. Neil, you learn the drums. I'll relearn the electric bass, and then our punk band is called Kit Harington's is in Belfast. And we'll be like huge in Europe,
huge in Ireland. We could play that pub.
We could. We would definitely have
we
to play
the
that
house
pub.
Band of that pub.
And we,
when are you guys
Kit
around? Only when Kit Harington's in Belfast.
Here's what I'm really worried about the spinoffs. Let me tell you. Let's go back to this for one hot second.
Sure.
Which is this.
They'll be set in the future.
That they announced
spinoffs. They will also be Westworld Season 3 because it's the same thing.
Dragon
They take place in a world of no women to try to counter-program Why the Last Man.
Oh.
George R.R. Martin actually directs all of the episodes. They decide to come up with an Asian-looking group of people and cast them entirely with white people.
it's a show about the people of Yiti, which is that's a place in the world of Westeros that...
Yeah.
It's a show about how sexual assault isn't really sexual assault if you think about it hard enough. No, okay, here's my nightmare.
It's called Game of Thrones 2. Okay, I'm done. Go ahead.
My nightmare is that Game of Thrones 2 will have no... will have no cast members that we're familiar with until season 3... when they realize they don't have the audience that they wanted, and they're like, guess what? Guess who's back in the
time traveling Jorah.
Okay, well, if it's Ian Glenn, then I'm not mad about it.
I will say this, guys. I looked up Yeti, which I was pretty sure was a known place in the known world. But it is also totally the Asia of Westeros,
because
it is a far eastern region known as the Golden Empire of Yeti.
Yeah, it's best not to talk about George R. Martin's ideas for things that are not Westeros.
It was, quote, definitely inspired by Imperial China.
Awesome.
Cool. Cool.
Game of Thrones 2, Yeti Chronicles.
The Warriors of Yeti. Anyway.
Starring Vin Diesel.
And a CGI reborn Paul Walker. It's called...
And Scarlett Johansson.
It's
reprising
called,
her role as an Asian Scarlett Johansson.
It's called Two Game, Two Thrones.
Tilda Swinton is the throne.
Tilda Swinton is Drogon. Anyway, let's talk about crocodiles for a second.
Yeah.
Last week, obviously, we talked about Black Mirror, and we were trying to determine the reason why that episode was called Crocodile. And we had several people email us great explanations about the nature of the title. And this one comes from Kolotkin, which sounds like a name. They say, as a trained zoologist, I view the name of the episode of Black Mirror Crocodile very appropriate. A crocodile is an ambush hunter that would lie in wait for their prey. Sometimes the crocodile is unnoticeable. They camouflage themselves pretty well. And you do not know that there is a hunter in sight until you get up real close and disturb the area. Then you die. Crocodiles are also fierce mothers and will protect their young. When you transfer that behavior to humans, I believe what you will witness occurs in the episode of Black Mirror. The main subject is a well-mannered mother that is living her life until she is disturbed enough, until she is disturbed enough when she gets too close to kill. What? Anyway, sorry. Her first kill was up close and personal, just like a crocodile, and it was a sudden jump to her victim. I would not be surprised if her skin was torn. We will witness something from the TV miniseries V. What does that mean?
Lizard people.
Lizard people.
Means like lizard people.
Whew. Okay, that makes more sense. The insurance agent again disturbed the area and then got killed. So this person is saying that it's about the way in which the killer sort of lies in waiting.
But this is missing all this limbic system stuff that I learned about.
I can read the other one too, because it's the other one takes it from a different angle, which means we have competing theories, which is very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be next week's great debate, isn't it?
Maybe. This one comes from Joseph in Cincinnati. He pointed out that Alyssa Wilkinson at Vox.com actually referenced this, and this is an excerpt from her piece in which she says, Crocodile takes place in the near future, in which we finally figured out how to tap into, record, and even manipulate our memories. Crocodile cognition isn't my particular specialty, but digging around a bit, I discovered that crocodile brains are apparently almost entirely limbic, which means they comprise the systems that house memories and the functions that support those memories, like smell and emotion. So Joseph goes on to theorize that it's about the way crocodiles remember things, and the how she gives them the beer and they sniff the beer. So it's all driven by other sensories.
Lembus bread.
Yeah. Joseph also points out that the thing, the little monitor thing she uses, kind of looks like a crocodile when it's opened up.
Yeah, a lot of people...
Did you just imply that lembus bread does something to your limbic system?
Why wouldn't it? A lot of people
did mention... It's very limbic of it.
A lot of people did mention that the device she used looks like the opening jaw... Like, when she opens it, it looks like the jaws opening of a crocodile.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So the crocodile... It's all of us. It's been inside all of us the whole time.
You know what this feels like? This feels like
the friends we made along the way.
The crocodile.
This feels like
the remembered all the way.
The essays we would do in high school. It was like, everybody write why you think this short story is titled blank.
Nobody's
except
wrong.
I actually enjoyed this exercise.
There are no wrong answers, everyone.
No, those are actually, I mean, we got both a zoologist and a sort of crazy theory. I like it. Well, no, we got medical information and zoology information. So it could either be behavioral or biological.
I like that we're having this debate on the Michael Crichton episode already, because strap in, guys.
Michael Crichton would appreciate this. This is the kind of debate.
Guys, exactly. It's about to get real science-y. Bunch of science coming to your face right now.
All right. We debated about how to jump into the Crichton the best. How we usually do this is how we, I guess, we're introduced to Crichton, is how we've done Star Wars spoilers in the past. I guess going first, when my brother was reading like Stephen King in those teenage years, I was reading Michael Crichton, and it of course started with wanting to read Jurassic Park after the movie came out, and then realizing that there were all these other movies based on Michael Crichton books. And so he was sort of my first adaptation author, where I would read Congo, then see Congo. I would read Sphere and then see Sphere. So I knew these movies were coming out. And then, of course, there are your older movies, your Train Robberies and Andromeda Strains. And so I would try my best to read the book and then see the movie. And the reason I liked it as a geeky male teenager who sort of has like a creative and physics brain is obviously the style of storytelling, like right on the edge of either historical fiction or science fiction, but still keeping it fact-based, is where I like my craziness. So that definitely drew Michael Crichton in for me. We're going to each try to pick one of our favorite books and our favorite movies to also go along with this. So I'm going to, by way of all of those things condensing into a weird book, I really enjoyed Sphere for its sci-fi like things that are wrapped around what it's like to live underwater and feel claustrophobic, and this scientist who came up with a way of theoretically talking to aliens, and then suddenly he has to execute this theoretical idea he had that he thought was kind of a joke. There's a lot of good things about scientists being scientists in Sphere, and unlike the movie, the book really benefits from being inside each of the characters' perspective for both the twists of what happens in the Sphere and for the claustrophobia of living underwater, which never really feels like a, I don't know, like a threat in the movie as much as like Sam Jackson feels like a threat in the movie. So Sphere the book, I think it's better than the movie. And that's how I got into Michael Crichton. Joanna, how about you? You're literary.
I read Jurassic Park before the movie came out. I read it in hardcover. So I read it the year it came out, and I just looked up what year it came out, and I was 9, which means I was too young to read Jurassic Park, but I read it anyway, and it gave me nightmares forever. I don't know why I read it at that age. I don't know how I found it. But I do know that I read a lot of Michael Crichton, a lot of John Grisham around that time. And, it taught me a lot about like sexy times and science and lawyering. So,
and sexy science and sexy lawyering.
Yeah. And then I did exactly what Dave said, like where I read Jurassic Park and then like a couple years later, in 93, the movie comes out. And then I did what Dave was saying, where I like, you know, if a Michael Crichton movie was coming out, I wanted to make sure that I read the book first. So I read Disclosure and Congo and Rising Sun and Sphere and Lost World and all of that, and eventually Timeline. So that would be my introduction to Michael Crichton. And then I say my favorite book.
Yeah.
Okay, I already talked about this, but I'm going to talk about it again because I feel like on slightly more solid territory than I did last time I talked about it. In 1988, Michael Crichton published a collection of nonfiction essays called Travels. Last time I said it was like 4 novellas. I'm wrong. It's just a bunch of essays. Some of them have to do with traveling. Some of them have to do with spirituality. Some of them have to do with making the Great Train Robbery. And some of them have to do with being a med student. And I think I said this last week as well, this is something that an ex-boyfriend of mine gave to me in college, and I just really, really liked it. And it helped me understand like how ER could be based on Michael Crichton's life and all of that sort of stuff. And so I, you know, given that I left Neil his choice. I'm very comfortable with this as a second
graciously.
I think pretty graciously. I'm pretty happy with this as a second choice. And I had a listener when I mentioned it last time. I had a listener, I don't know, tweet at me or email or something like that, saying like that Travels used to be their go-to like book to give someone. I think it is just like a really good gift book, because it's nonfiction, but like Crichton is just, it's funny because I was reading an article on him today where I guess he never thought he was a good author. He thought it was just something that he worked really, 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 really hard at, but not something he was naturally gifted at. But I think he's just a naturally entertaining author. And so these essays, especially given that it gives you sort of a glimpse inside the head of the person who created a bunch of narratives that were so formative to at least one decade, if not like three. So yeah, Travels. I really recommend it. And that's the book I'm talking about.
Neil, you apparently got the prize choice.
Yeah.
How did you get into Michael Crichton, and which is your favorite book?
Well, it's very appropriate. It's all sort of a cyclical thing that winds in movies and books, and really just one movie and one book. I remember seeing the trailer for Jurassic Park. So this would have been 1993, maybe late 1992. I don't remember exactly when the trailer came out, but I remember seeing the trailer for Jurassic Park. And if you remember this trailer, there's a lot of, like, it's a ton of exposition. Like, it gives away most of the movie, but they don't really show the dinosaurs. And so I remember being a kid, I think I was like 9 or 10. And I just remember wanting to know more about the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, this movie that was coming out in X amount of months. So I got the paperback, which I still have somewhere, and read it before the movie came out and was just enthralled with all of that. So it started with Jurassic Park. That'll always be my favorite. One of my favorite books of all time, just because it's great. And it continued on to there. You know, Sphere was another favorite of mine. That's kind of, mine's pretty easy. Mine is like everybody's. Everybody did the Jurassic Park thing. I am the everyman, okay? But I also read Sphere and Congo and The Lost World and some other ones that I can't really remember. The Andromeda Strain. I think I read that one.
I can't think after I read Jurassic Park and then I saw the movie, I was like, it was pre-Lost World book coming out. I just like couldn't get enough. And I think that's what led me to read Raptor Red by Robert Backer, which is a narrative set entirely from the perspective of a mother raptor. And it is a long science book about how the raptors lived that I mistook for a narrative.
It's all raptor theory.
Yeah, I think you got the proper amount of dinosaur-ness for your child curiosity.
Right.
I went a little too far.
Yeah, basically it was like Jurassic Park and then the dinosaurs book, like the big picture book that just had all the different kinds of dinosaurs in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You guys remember that one?
I do.
And then eventually Dinotopia.
Dinotopia, yeah.
Do you know there are 4 Dinotopia books, Joanna?
I did know that because I used to work in a bookstore.
It's fucking insane.
Almost
I didn't realize there was one until
Land Before Time movies.
I want
not anywhere close to Land Before Time movies, but point taken.
I want
so many Land Before Time movies.
I want to hold on. I want to point out a bit of trivia in case there's like people listening who I know we have listeners who are younger than we are, and so sometimes when we travel down these paths that like mean like. It's easy for us to understand the importance of Michael Crichton in the decade of the 90s. But people who are younger, didn't live through it, might not know some things. Like, for example, this bit of trivia that I encountered. Which is, because Michael Crichton created the TV show ER, which was super popular, in 1995, he had the number one best-selling book, The Lost World, the number one movie in the country, Congo, and the number one TV show, ER. And then 1996, he did the same again with the book Airframe, the movie Twister, and once again ER. So for 2 years, smack in the middle of the decade, this dude was the lord of like the pop culture. Like at least like he was the undisputed king for 2 years, and he was like a prince for the rest of the decade. It's like it's impossible to underestimate sort of what he meant in shaping all of that. And he has a bunch of people who just kind of worship. We'll talk about sort of some of his more problematic aspects, but like he has a bunch of people who worship the ground and he walks on, including Steven Spielberg, who was like the most fun I ever had in my life was working with Michael Crichton. Like whether it was on Twister or on Jurassic Park, you know, like Spielberg is just like, yeah, Crichton, he's the man for me. So, and it's kind of amazing what Crichton did because, once again, I'm not ignoring problematic stuff. We're going to get to it, but the marriage of like popcorn entertainment, big entertainment, and like science, like technical aspects is kind of incredible. And like, we've leaned a bit harder into fantasy now. And so like, not that that doesn't require craft, but like, you know, the things we learned about string theory or thought we understood about string theory because we read Michael Crichton is kind of, it's kind of amazing that we got like at least a dabbling of education along with our
or DNA or chaos theory.
Yeah. Or, DNA,
human biology
or AI
surgery as in ER. Cause that was, we'll talk about ER in a little bit, but that was one of the things I was reminded of when I rewatched it was how like technical it was. Which is surprising because you always just remember that show is like, oh, it's the one with George Clooney.
I mean, I didn't because my dad and mom, my dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse, and like they always said that ER was the show that was the most like accurate in terms of medical shows calling out jargon.
Well, that's
like,
interesting.
ER was actually accurate and other shows weren't. So I did know that about it, but yeah, it's certainly not, you know, like I think a lot of us, like if we know to say like, you know, what intubate is or whatever, like we wouldn't necessarily say, oh, of course, because I learned that from ER. Maybe you think you learned it from Grey's Anatomy. Who knows? But yeah. And ER was on air for 15 years, which is just fucking insane. So, you know, I don't think we have cultural monoliths like Michael Crichton anymore. And
yeah, I mean, think about how popular George R.R. Martin is, and all he has is a TV show at the moment.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have any books out. So it would be like if George R.R. Martin did...
if like a wild card movie were number one.
Right. And, and the book, George's latest book came out, like, and he put out like a book a year. Or one every what Crichton like, was more, at his height.
Not,
was like
no, not even with Twister. It would be like he wrote a new Game of Thrones book. Game of Thrones was on, and he wrote Black Panther. Like that would be what like the equivalent would be, I guess.
I know. I think the equivalent is one more than that, which is that they're three different stories altogether. Like only one could be Game of Thrones. You know what I mean? Like
right. Martin so it'd be like having Game Martin of Thrones famous, on.
Yeah, Martin is famous for a series. Crichton only did, I think, one sequel, right? The Lost World, that's it. So, yeah. I mean, he did also tell kind of the same story over and over again a couple times, which is that our creations will destroy us. But
right. It's pre-Black Mirror.
Well, to be fair, the Jurassic franchise has been unable to tell any other stories either. So maybe he just mined it all out.
Yeah.
That maybe that's the angle on dinosaurs. You know, we came up with one good angle on dinosaurs, and he got it in 1990.
In his in his favor was that he is much taller than George R. R. Martin.
He's 6'9", guys. It's insane.
Or he was previously when he was alive.
That is insane. Let's move on to our favorite Crichton movie so we can start talking about ER, because chomping at the bit for that, because it's on Hulu, everybody. In case you didn't notice, you could watch all of ER right now.
All 15 years worth.
And crazy, which, you know, some people are. I'm not going to bemoan that. Speaking of crazy things that are sort of about completionists, Did you guys know that Michael Crichton shadow directed the end of The 13th Warrior, my favorite Michael Crichton movie? It's by far my favorite Michael Crichton movie, not the best Michael Crichton movie, because I can't say that it's perfect, but this retelling of Beowulf based on Eaters of the Dead with Antonio Banderas in the lead is super enjoyable for what it is. It kind of ended up being a mess in production because John McTiernan, the director before, went over budget and over schedule, and Crichton was like, it's okay, I've got this. Went in, did 3 weeks, says afterwards he's very happy with the movie. I believe him. It's totally fun to watch. And in terms of like all these movies of people using like foreign languages and meeting other cultures, and they all speak English, even if they're from an alien planet or for whatever, The 13th Warrior has a great scene that I'm convinced is only in there because Michael Crichton got to do the last cut of Antonio Banderas's even character slowly learning the language of the Vikings by listening to them talk around the fireside, and it transitions into English. So you know as the storyteller that you're now hearing everything in the native language of whoever you're seeing. It's a really clever way of going about it. I wish more blockbusters did it. If they're not going to do subtitles, it's a good way. It's a good way of making it part of the storytelling and giving your main character some intelligence. Not that he needed that because he's fighting, Beowulf monsters, but not important. Joanna, what's your favorite Michael Crichton movie?
Other than the obvious one, I decided to go with The Great Train Robbery, starring Sean Connery, Donald Sutherland, and Leslie Ann Down. And from 1978, and it's a heist movie. So, like, what's not to love? A train heist movie with, like, splendid hats and wisecracking Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland. Crichton directed this one, and based on his book. And he loved Sean Connery so much, they became, like, lifelong friends, that he wrote a character in the book The Rising Sun called John Connor, who is definitely a Sean Connery character, and then Sean Connery played him in the movie. So, it's not as good as like The Sting, which is a similar sort of like era of like fancy men and crime, but for an example, like if you read the book Travels, which is sort of about him making it, or if you listen to his the commentary on the Great Train Robbery DVD of him talking about making the movie, like it's just such a fascinating look inside someone who like was never satisfied with what he did, was always frustrated. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie, but as like an examination of Michael Crichton and his craft, I think it's a really interesting artifact. So The Great Train Robbery, my pick.
Nice. I actually read that this week because I hadn't before. And after Dragon Teeth, I'm like, what's going to be not Whiplash? And I'm like, probably The Great Train Robbery.
Did you like it? I was
totally right. Oh, yeah, I did like it. Yeah. I mean, it's of a piece with Dragon Teeth for a couple of reasons that we could talk about later. But I definitely enjoyed it as like one of my favorite periods of London history. And then Ocean's 11 is set inside of it.
Yep.
So it's great.
It's definitely Ocean's 11-Z.
Neil, I'm guessing you get to pick the definitive answer, but what's your favorite Michael Crichton movie?
I'm going with Jurassic Park, and here's why. There's a specific thing about Michael Crichton and Jurassic Park that I think gets lost, and it's the changes that they made, both Spielberg and Crichton, to turn what was a really interesting novel into a really, really accessible movie. Like, they did a lot of very specific things when they adapted this. Like, in the books, the doctors who work for InGen on the island are, like, main characters. And they get kind of reduce the technical aspects of it, but they still made it fun with like Mr. DNA and all that stuff. They actually switched Tim and Lex. Like in the books, Tim's the older one who's nerdy and Lex is like into sports. They also did stuff like in the book, spoiler alert, Hammond dies and is kind of a dick. is far more like cynical and greedy and like a worse person. But then they cast Richard Attenborough and they're like, they made him this sort of lovable, still sort of the bad guy, but not really as bad. So I think Jurassic Park is not only an example of a really great story that became one of the great movies of all time, it's also a really interesting example of adaptation and what, you know, people really did at the time. As far as I know, the Jurassic Park book was very well liked. So for them to make some of these fairly significant changes was pretty bold. So it just goes to show, because Crichton on Jurassic Park was not, he was involved, right?
Yep.
Yeah, he was involved in the script. So it's really interesting to me that he was the kind of author who was totally cool, kind of making huge changes to his own story to make something essentially more accessible in my mind.
Steven, what are we going to do with my tables of DNA coding? I really feel it's important to the plot. Well,
and Spielberg's like, we're just going to put it in the background. It's fine.
I was talking, we were chatting about movies made from books this morning on the Little Gold Men podcast. And my boss, Mike Hogan, said something that I have agreed with for a long time, which is that the best movies are made out of like only okay books. I'm not saying Jurassic Park is an only okay book, but it's a light book, and though it's more complicated on the page, like Jurassic Park. I don't know. I'm not articulating myself well, but the point being, like, if you take a dense tome and you try to put all of it on the screen, it's just never, ever, 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 ever going to work. But if you can just strip out a light story and throw it up there, then that's what you should go with. I really like the changes to Jurassic Park. We were talking about, especially since nobody eats a baby's face. We were talking about, before we started the podcast today, I found out while like sort of reading up on Michael Crichton that he had 5 wives over the course of his life. One for like
each wife had 7 sacks and each sack had 7 cats.
One for every like foot and a half of his body or something like that. I don't know. I don't do math, but so I made a joke to Neil about like how Michael Crichton was always on the lookout for the future ex Mrs. Crichton, right? Like that a lanky, oftentimes married, sciencey guy,
who somehow manages to be a quote rock star unquote mathematician.
Right. I mean, I don't think Crichton considered himself a rock star at all. He certainly didn't dress in like black leather, but and so then the question Neil was asking me is like, well, do you know, like, what do we think is the most Michael Crichton like avatar character in a book? And like, I was thinking just even specifically about Jurassic Park, and we'll get to ER in a second, but like, I don't think he is just Dr. Ian Malcolm, because he's also definitely Hammond. You know what I mean? Like, he's also definitely, I think, Grant, like I and hopefully some of the lady characters as well. So I think that Crichton did do a good job of sort of, it's not like he created like amazing complex in-depth characters by any stretch of the imagination, but he, I think he did a good job of creating like multifaceted and splintering himself off into multiple characters. I think the same can be said for ER, if that's...
Yeah, I actually, it's funny when you mention that. I think that ER is a great example of that, mm-hmm. which is what we're talking about next. So there's a good transition.
Yeah, ER. It stands for emergency room.
So here's
that's the
deal.
Worst transition.
We decided to do this podcast before Hulu announced that they were putting all mm-hmm. the episodes up. I swear to God, we did
I think
not
we,
have
I think we
knowledge.
Announced it on our show, which came out, what, last Wednesday, Thursday, and then like that Hulu thing didn't happen until like Friday.
Yeah, we were very prescient, which means that I did not get to rewatch all of ER. I think it was actually impossible from when the announcement happened to when we're recording.
Oh, definitely impossible.
Dave did the Dave did the actual assignment, which is read a book. But you know, I watched a couple episodes of ER when I was down in LA kicking around a hotel room, and Neil watched the pilot today, which is like, I think it's a 90-minute pilot.
Yeah.
And it's great. I mean, I watched, I think, like the first 5 episodes of the season, and it's super good. And I definitely had not rewatched the pilot since I saw it when it originally aired, which was like 24 years ago or something like that. It's a very well done pilot. These are great and iconic characters that they created. Obviously, it's not just the George Clooney of it all. You know, like Anthony Edwards is fantastic. Noah Wiley is John Carter. You know, and like
Eric LaSalle.
Eric LaSalle is so good as Benton. A lot of William H. Macy, Juliana Margulies, babyface Juliana Margulies. Like, it's a freaking great pilot. So if you've never watched ER or you haven't a long time, you should probably go check it out on Hulu. But this is based off of a screenplay that Crichton had written years and years before called Code Blue, based on his own experience as a resident at Harvard Medical School. And Steven Spielberg was going to direct, and eventually they decided to make it a TV show. Steven Spielberg, I think, co-executive produced. And I believe John Wells was the official showrunner, I believe. But they... I read this great tidbit about Michael Crichton today, which is that he looked up, he was like, you know, he's an obsessive person who had like kept files and all the like various things he was interested in. And when he decided sort of like what he wanted to do as a career, like as a young man, he researched and discovered that there were only 200 writers in America who were making a living out of writing, but saw that there were 6,000 students graduated as doctors. He was being very pragmatic about it. And that's when he decided to become a doctor and went undercover as a writer. And he was writing under a pseudonym when he was like in med school and stuff like that. So, I just love that that's why Michael Crichton became a doctor, because it was like I crunched the numbers and that's what I decided to do.
Being a writer will make me poor. I'm going to be a doctor instead.
But this notion that we've talked about throughout of this like a marriage of excellent pop, or in ER's case, occasional soap entertainment with actual medical or scientific knowledge is kind of incredible. And one last thing before I roll over to you guys, one of my favorite things that I discovered about watching those ER episodes is that sometimes a patient will just come in and get helped in a couple minutes and leave and never come back. And I swear that's not true for medical shows anymore. Like, if a patient comes in and is helped and leaves, they're going to come back later bleeding from somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, it's gonna have to pay off later. But this is like a bunch of little red herrings where it's just like, nope, sometimes it's just a wound on my hand. Yeah, sometimes it's just you got to suture it up and send them home, and they never come back, and it's fine. I was like, oh, that's clever, because like, you know, House and like the twistiness of Grey's Anatomy and stuff like that, like medical procedurals afterwards have sort of taught us to look for the twist or whatever, and sometimes it's just like, sometimes in ER there's just no fucking twist. So anyway, ER, it's a show.
ER.
It's part of the whatever we call the era before the golden age of television, where television drama is becoming what it is today and allowed to be serialized and allowed to deal with more complex characters and allowed, like Joanna's talking about, to have red herrings necessarily. All of these ideas were new. And so I think it's there's a book called Everything Bad is Good for You. How today's popular culture is making you smarter. And it talks about there's this period of time in television in the early 90s where television writers, through having to turn out all these different shows but still wanting it to be complex, starts planting in the idea of how television works in the current viewer's brain. So what Joanna's talking about not being used to see somebody show up and just get fixed and go out, that's slowly something that we learned because ER was allowed to exist and change for like 15 years. But like, otherwise, let's look really quickly, if we want to, at the fall of 1994. There was a Free Willy series on ABC that like never made it. The Secret World of Alex Mack,
yes,
debuted.
Yes.
Star Trek The Next Generation ended.
Wow.
And let's see. Gargoyles went into syndication. Ah, Real Monsters. Earth 2. Does anybody remember Earth 2?
Nope.
It existed for one season. That was 1994.
The X-Files was on.
X-Files was on, Party of Five was on, there were NYPD Blue was on, My So-Called Life was on. There were some stuff doing the same good work, but ER was by far the most popular.
It always felt like NYPD Blue and ER kind of went together.
Yeah, I think so. Although that's not the one they crossed over with, did they?
No, I don't.
They crossed over with Third Watch.
Yeah.
ER crossed over with Third Watch?
No, no. Yes, yes.
Oh. And Friends, obviously.
Yeah.
They
but
did.
But it did always feel like they were of a piece, those two, ER and NYPD Blue. Maybe it's just because that's what my mom watched.
That's funny.
Like,
I wasn't allowed
the week.
I wasn't allowed to watch NYPD Blue, so
oh, because of all the butts.
Like, it's weird because there were like no rules in my house, so I don't know why I wasn't allowed to watch NYPD Blue, but I wasn't. But I was allowed to watch ER, and ER, like, for so long, Must See TV Thursday was like a four sitcoms, and then ER. It was like 3 hours of your life where NBC owned you hardcore every week. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's we don't, I mean, we do have some, you know, we have Game of Thrones, but that's only for like, you know, 10 weeks out of the year. ER was 22 episodes or maybe more, I don't know. And like, and
well, then also it's like with those even Game of Thrones' biggest episode is not anywhere close to right. what ER was pulling in week to week.
Right. So, you know, and there was, and then like, you know, this is hard to explain to, you know, people just coming up now into television where there is not really that much of a difference between like a movie star and a TV star. But the fact that like an early episode of ER, Ewan McGregor was on an episode, which was like a very important episode to me because of how much I loved Ewan McGregor. That's a crazy thing that happened. So, you know, and I didn't Tarantino direct an episode of ER. I think he did.
That sounds like enough of a fact to
maybe not. Fact. Maybe not. I mean,
I know he did a CSI once because I watched that and it was like, damn it, you got me to watch CSI. Damn you, stunt directors.
No, he did do an episode of ER.
Tarantino did.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. There's this shot that I remember of Sherry Stringfield and Jelena Margulies in sunglasses, like walking past the camera and then like trying to look at it, that I'm 99% sure comes from the Tarantino episode. Anyway. ER is not, I feel like it's a show, like, people got really, I'm trying to figure out why people lost their minds when they found out it was all going to go on Hulu, because it's been in syndication for, you know, like, there was a solid decade where you could find it every single morning on TNT, you know? But I think it's because it was this monolith of a show that we, like, couldn't find a way to talk about once it was gone. Like, we can still talk about Lost. We will talk about Game of Thrones. We've talked about The Sopranos. We've talked about Breaking Bad. But once again, it might be that Michael Crichton thing where it's just like we kind of tend to dismiss it as like a light pop medical procedural, maybe not worthy of like academic discussion. And so it gets left out of TV discussions. But it was so important for so long. You know, and it did certain things, or, you know, like what happens to Jelena Margulies' character in the pilot is like a crazy thing for a TV show. Now that shit happens all the time. A, that shit happens all the time. And B, like, it would have been ruined for us on Twitter by like a million different coy headlines and stuff like that before we even got a chance to watch the episode. What happens to Kelly Martin's character is a crazy thing. You know, like they're just, it was a more innocent time of TV watching, but ER was really good at like pressing these boundaries, you know? So, or like, didn't, I'm pretty sure that one of the doctor characters like lost his arm with a helicopter blade at one point.
Well, like, I think why people are so excited about the Hulu thing is because now you finally know if you're watching all of the ER. Like, ER is still back from one of those times in television where it's like, if you didn't have a friend who put it on VHS tape, you have to wait till it's syndicated, and if you have to wait till it's syndicated, that might not be in order. So, like, maybe it's the excitement of finally being able to fill in your ER gaps. At least for me, I always remember drifting in and out of, like, episodes. Like, there'd be an episode, and everybody'd be talking about the episode coming up, and I'd drift in to see that part of the episode, or see that cliffhanger, or see that resolve. But I don't remember necessarily every week tuning in to make sure that I didn't miss ER. It was more of a, it was there when everybody else told me that I needed to watch it because I was a child. So obviously, why? I guess it'd be weirder if I was a child that taped all of ER.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's going to be fun to revisit that as Hulu, you know, rakes up its money while it could still exist before Disney strikes it down.
No, you're hilarious. Disney's going to use Hulu to try to crush Netflix. The reverse is true. Disney wants Hulu.
Disney wants Hulu's stuff, but they have the majority shareholder thing, so if they move stuff over to the Disney service, they could shut down Hulu?
Sure. But no, they also want original programming.
I'm just saying that it would seem weird for them to have a two streaming services, one of which they don't own entirely. But like what you're saying is also, this is just inside baseball of people who pay attention to buying and stuff, and has nothing to do with Michael Crichton, which we should continue talking about because we actually had a mini homework assignment that I think I'm the only one that did.
Dave, I feel really bad that you did this. I did buy the book. So that at least shows some good faith that, like, I meant to do the homework. But
well, what happened is somebody bought the book, and then I guess Neil bought the book first.
Yeah.
And then Joanna bought the book. And then I'm like, oh, damn it, they're going to make me do this. Then I bought the book, and then I read the book, and then I was like, let's do this podcast. And that just wasn't enough time for you guys to look at that cover and be like, now is the time to read about the Bone Wars from what Michael Crichton thought about them in 1974. We're talking about Dragon Teeth. It's the third posthumous book released by the Crichton estate. He wrote it in 74, never finished it. It is about the Bone Wars of 1878, I think, 1876, somewhere in there. True story, two crazy professors go into the wild, wild west, try to capture as many fossils as possible from contested territories during the Sioux Wars. And caught in the middle is a rich Yale gentleman who on a bet follows one of these archaeologists west and then happens into crazy western historically accurate problems like... Indian raiding parties and dumb soldiers that get drunk and harass anybody that doesn't look like they belong. And then he eventually ends up in Deadwood, where he meets some famous Deadwood characters while trying to protect some fossils.
What?
Yeah, there's like a third of this book takes place in Deadwood.
What? This is like when you guys told me that the OA stands for Original Angel.
I'm just going to do like a synopsis since I read it. Here we go. Rich kid in Yale is going to go vacation in Europe, but gets in a fight about how he's basically a pussy with this other kid. And they make $1,000 bet, which is tons of money in the 1870s, that he's not going to go west. So he finagles his way on this archaeological expedition. Because of that, he, sort of becomes suspect to the professor leading the expedition, a professor named Marsh. He's a real character. He existed and was very much like he's portrayed in the books. Marsh decides that our main character, William, is actually secretly a spy for Cope, the other professor who's part of the Bone Wars, and so ditches him in Wyoming. And Cope comes along and is like, I'm sorry this happened to you, but I could also be your leader on the team since you're already out here. So he decides to go with Cope's people up to the Montana Territory, where they discover the first Brontosaurus fossils, specifically the teeth, dragon teeth. Yes, I know Brontosaurus isn't a real dinosaur. This book was written before that happened. So just stick with it. They package up these teeth. Marsh shows up, thinks that he's been proven right, that this guy was a turncoat, and so they have to flee with the teeth and try to stay out of the way of the various forts, which are not only fighting the Sioux, but Marsh is much more politically accepted by the U.S. government, so he's been telling lies at all these forts that Cope's party are murderers and whatnot. So they have to secretly flee with all these fossils. They get separated and double-crossed from Cope, who has all the money to get them home. So it's just William and this other tracker The tracker eventually dies, and William rolls into the closest town, all haggard, and with these crates full of dinosaur bones, and it turns out that the town he rolls into is Deadwood. So he spends some time in Deadwood, where he's trying to keep these fossils secret. Everybody thinks they're gold and not fossils, so he sort of has a target on his back. He accidentally gets into a disagreement with like the main gangster of Deadwood, shoots him, doesn't kill him, realizes he needs to get the fuck out of there. Luckily, Wyatt Earp comes rolling in at just the correct time. He pays off Wyatt Earp to come with his coach and take the fossils back down to Cheyenne. And is helped along by a mysterious woman he loves, but never becomes intimate with. He goes back to Cheyenne. Earp turns out is a better friend than he appears, even though it looks like he's going to double cross them at some point. And it, the woman ends up being the daughter of a railroad magnate who is like, oh, I guess you don't love me. You just care about bones. And then fucks out of the story and we never talk to her again. He brings the bones back to Philadelphia. He's like, I've got your dragon teeth. And his dad's like, you really grew up. You're not an East Coast pussy anymore. End of book.
Amazing. I'm really glad that you read this. we have to wrap up pretty soon, and we made a couple promises that we have to deliver on before we go. Really quickly, Dave, I want to ask you, would you recommend Michael Crichton fans read Dragon Teeth?
Yes. This is going to be a great thing to read come the summer. Your beaches, your travelings, your audiobooks. It is super light. It's very Crichton in the sense that they arrive at a town and we spend two pages about the history of the town and why its architectural layout the way it is the way it is. And then, of course, there's, you know, your classic archaeologists and dueling scientists that you would expect from Crichton. It's not good Crichton, like, oh my God, this is the best. But if you like Michael Crichton and you need something new to, you know, pump your gas, Dragon Teeth isn't that bad. It's really brief.
Okay, we should talk quickly before we go about the way in which Michael Crichton's legacy sort of soured at the end of his life. He became a very strong and vocal climate change denier. The bad guys in State of Fear are environmentalists. I think he called environmentalism like a radical religion or something like that. When interviewed about this, a lot of his very smart friends, after his death, when interviewed about this, a lot of his smart friends were like, I can only hope that if he saw the science that we have now, he would have changed his mind. His argument was more that he felt like we didn't know enough to believe in climate change. I mean, I would disagree with him, but like he didn't have as much information as we have now. First of all, I'm not defending him. I'm just saying that's what many people are saying. Secondly, there's some other problematic books like Rising Sun, which is published as early as 92, which is like very racist against Japanese people. Disclosure, which was like if you decide to read that book now, which is about a woman who falsely accuses a subordinate male and ex-boyfriend of sexually harassing her as vengeance because he turns her down for sex. That's a really bad premise. It's like a very, very, very bad, very hideously sexist premise. Yeah, so, you know, good old Crichton.
He had a lot of old ideas.
He had some old ideas, you know, like just stick to the dinosaurs. Stick to your really old ideas, like the fossil ideas and not these other ideas, buddy. So, you know, like, we can maybe save this debate for another time of whether or not that should like crap all over his entire legacy. I don't think it should, but, you know, it's.
Well, I'll contribute this one thing, which is that honestly think that sometimes he had no idea like when he was flirting with controversy in how he was presenting what he saw as his science or his whatnot. So like in The Great Train Robbery, there's a whole chapter about like having sex with a virgin curing syphilis, and he never comes out and says that's stupid. And it's just at the end, the character dies of, quote, mysterious circumstances. And you're supposed to be like, yes, of course, the virgin didn't cure him of syphilis. But in the book, it's just presented. In the book, it's presented like, of course, you should know this. So I keep thinking things like Rising Sun is just like what his friends are saying, like idiocy of the time presented not as like a way of trying to enforce a viewpoint, but just Michael Crichton being like, this is black and white. And of course, people are with me on my crazy journey of this being interesting. I don't know, maybe you don't want to read statistics about disease and Andromeda strain, But that's something that Michael Crichton makes you do, just like he essentially brings up that having sex with a virgin used to be a cure for syphilis. Not that I needed to see that scene, but hey.
Just means that now the virgin has syphilis, right?
Yeah, you've just multiplied the syphilis.
Yeah. All right, anything else we want to say on the subject? I'm sorry, Neil, I feel like I cut you off a little bit. We're just a little tight on time this week.
No, we're all good. I guess we're just going to have to do Crichton part two.
Crichton part two.
He did leave, apparently, a ton of notes behind, and there's already been three books to come out of those notes. So
yeah,
might be very possible.
Yeah. If you guys have any like questions or comments or feedback on Crichton, please do email us them. We always love reading your emails if they're about crocodiles or Crichton or whatever else. So thank you very much.
All right. And Neil, what are you up to next week?
Oh, I'm going to Sundance. But we as a podcast are going to be doing another great debate on a topic that we are going to announce on Twitter at some point in the next couple of days. But another fine debate, I'm sure. Who knows what it'll be about.
All right. And until then, where can people find more of your work online? Miss Joanna Robinson.
Find me on vanityfair.com. You can listen to me talk about the new FX series American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, on the new podcast Still Watching, Colin Versace. Or you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And Mr. Neil Miller?
You can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, where I'll be writing some stuff from the aforementioned Sundance. You can also listen. I'm going to be doing several podcasts from Sundance on One Perfect Pod. And a little fun fact to send you guys away, that Jake Lloyd, who played Anakin Skywalker in the prequels, back when he was in his Jingle All the Way days, did four episodes of ER in 1996. So woo! Just proof that pretty much everybody was on ER. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Rejects.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find the rest of the podcast at stormofspoilers.com. One more plug for Joanna's Versace podcast. You can listen to her talk to Ricky Martin right now. If you download that podcast, I've listened to it. You should listen to it. It's Ricky Martin. And until next week, hit us with emails at stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Tweet at us at stormofspoilers. And enjoy these tables of facts as you don't fall down.